Hi, this is Emma Sutherland. Join us on FX Medicine next week, where I'll be talking to Kira Sutherland about metabolism in women over 40. Subscribe to us on your favourite podcast app and follow us on social media to make sure you never miss an episode. Hi, and welcome to FX Medicine by Bioceuticals, where we bring you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. FX Medicine by Bioceuticals acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia, where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respect to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. With us today is Dr. Nick Fuller, who is Clinical Trials Director at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital Endocrinology Department. Nick works at the Charles Perkins Centre as an obesity and metabolic disease researcher and author. He is passionate about a holistic approach to the treatment of obesity, and today we're going to discuss sustainable weight loss. At FX Medicine, we have covered the topic of metabolism from various angles, but today I want to learn more about sustainable weight loss and how to achieve that in our clinics. Welcome to FX Medicine, Nick. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Now, to get this started, can you tell us a bit about the work that you do at the Charles Perkins Centre?
Yes, absolutely. So day to day, I am working at the University of Sydney and Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. In Charles Perkins Centre, we have Australia's largest weight management clinic. Now, in that service, we're actually running our hospital clinics for the treatment of overweight, obesity, metabolic disease, but also parallel to that, we're running all of our research programs to paint a better picture of what long-term weight management looks like. And that's everything from first-line therapy being lifestyle intervention. When I'm talking about lifestyle intervention, it's evidence-based care around diet, exercise, and sleep, but also everything else through the spectrum, including natural medicines, pharmaceutical drugs, medical devices, and surgery. So, yes, that's where I work day to day. And a large part of my role is also obviously translating a lot of this evidence-based care to the general public who are in need of that information.
Well, talking about in need of it, obesity is so highly prevalent in Australia, with 35% of Australians overweight and 28% obese. And I read some statistics that projected those numbers were going to increase to 41% and 34% respectively by the end of this year. And a study published in the Australian Journal of General Practice in 2023 found that among individuals who had lost at least 5% of their body weight in the past 3 years, only 27% maintained that weight loss for 1 year or more. So I want to pick your brains. What is the prevalence of successful weight loss?
Yes, it's not great when we look at the long-term outcomes. Now, you just reported on some data of sort of one-year success, but really when we're talking about long-term, it's similar to what we're talking about when we refer to remission from cancer. And that's why we need to focus on sort of 5 years and beyond. Now, unfortunately, most people are stacking that weight back on plus a little more after their diet or weight loss attempt within that five-year period. And people are going back and cycling time and time again. Women are very good at putting up their hand and trying to do something about their weight, but sadly, they're buying into the same diets and weight loss programs time and time again. They're doing that, data shows, up to five times every year.
Oh, wow.
And spending anywhere around 30 years plus of their life dieting. So they're going through this time and time again. We're seeing the repercussions of these, I guess, efforts when they come into our clinic and present with these frustrations. And the reason why they keep going back to diet and try that, I guess, program again is because they believe they failed due to a lack of willpower. They think they just didn't stick to it for long enough and that if they go back, they'll get long-term success. But this is where our research comes into play. at looking what happens within the body when a person's losing weight, because obesity is a very complex science. Our body's very good at protecting against weight loss, and hence why we tend to put the weight back on. And coming back to your question, fewer than 5% are actually succeeding long-term beyond the five-year mark.
Mm.
We all talk about the short-term wins, you know, on the latest and greatest diets.
Mm-hmm.
There's no questioning that people lose weight in 3 months, 6 months. Then it tends to plateau.
Mm-hmm.
What we're not talking about is that long-term pain that people go through where they do see the weight coming back on, and often a reversal of their health back to where they started, and if not in a worse off position.
We often see that in clinical practice. And I really want to take this episode to dive really quite deeply into this and to pick your brains for as many clinical pearls as possible, because we sense and we see the frustration, and it is so palpable. And the impact of weight is not just physical, it's psychological, it's emotional. It's so heavily weighted in so many ways. I want you to tell us a little bit about the evolutionary mismatch that you feel is driving the current obesity epidemic, and what do you feel we can learn from this as practitioners that are sitting across the table from these patients?
This is a very strong educational, I guess, point that we do need to be able to get across to patients, because if we can equip them with that information, they feel more empowered to make the right decision and evidence-based solutions next time they go and lose weight or attempt to lose weight. Now, the real reason they're failing is not due to that lack of willpower. Most of us are very good at sticking to diets.
Mm.
Now, some of them, of course, are very drastic and tell us to cut out whole food groups or certain foods, and they're severely restricted in terms of their calorie intake. Now, they're obviously not going to be able to stick to those for as long. But even the ones that and more balanced, unfortunately, there's something else going on within the body the minute people start losing that weight. And this does come down to evolution. It is an evolutionary problem. So if we go back tens of thousands of years, food wasn't available on every corner of every block. There was often long times of deprivation when we weren't foraging and hunting or when food wasn't available. And consequently, our body learnt to shut down. It learned to drop its metabolism and hold on to its body weight. And that was in order to procreate and survive.
Mm.
Now, you fast forward to the modern day environment. Unfortunately, food's on every corner of every block. We have a hard time saying no to it. We also get more very sedentary. We get very little movement when we evolve to move, and we're not getting that day-to-day incidental activity. And we're also getting poor sleep health. So consequently, what we're seeing is this weight creep.
Mm-hmm.
Our body's going up by about 0.5 to 1 kilo every year. And then what happens? We look in the mirror and we've quickly stacked on that 5 to 10 kilos, and we react to the problem. But unfortunately, we react to what the dieting industry is selling us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often quick fixes, fad diets, which, yes, you will get short-term weight loss on. There's no questioning that.
Mm.
But then the body starts to shut down, and it starts to shut down. Our research shows after just 3 kilos of weight loss, or about 5% of your body weight. Now, what that means is your metabolism drops, your appetite hormones start changing, telling you to eat more, your adrenal glands start pumping out cortisol, your thyroid gland becomes suppressed. So this is all basically your body working against you in order to protect its weight and send you back to its start point. It doesn't know any better.
Yeah.
And it's got to do this in order, remember, to survive and procreate. And this is the very reason why we have such a hard time keeping that weight off long term, because you lose a little bit of weight, your body starts going into shutdown mode and says, hang on, I've got to go back to my start point, and I've got to put on a little bit of extra fat to prepare for that next bout of starvation that might be around the corner.
And what actually happens hormonally, and what neural adaptations occur during this weight loss?
Yeah, it's quite fascinating. So, look, when we start taking blood samples, hormones of interest, particularly the appetite regulation system.
Mm.
So if I get a person to lose weight on a diet or a calorie-restricted plan, their appetite hormones start changing. Now, one in particular, which is produced from the stomach, which most of us are familiar with, is called ghrelin. Now, this is one that acts on a clever part of the brain called the hypothalamus, telling us to go and reach for food. This is the one that you know, when you get the hunger pangs in the stomach and it's sort of gurgling away, well, that's ghrelin levels being produced telling you to go and reach for food. And again, in order to sort of survive and procreate. Now, as you start to lose weight, the ghrelin levels actually surge. So ghrelin levels go higher than baseline. They go higher than what they normally were. And this is, again, in order to ensure you get more calories in and to put that weight back on that you are losing. So this is one example of a hormone imbalance that's happening as we start to lose weight. But you've got a whole cascade of different hormones that's changing. We've got other appetite hormones that are being, well, I guess the inverse relationship where they're being suppressed. So instead of usually telling you to put the fork down, they're going up telling you to continue to eat, such as GLP-1 and CCK. But you've got other hormones produced from other organs, like the adrenal glands, for instance, where cortisol is being pumped out. All of these factors are at play to ensure you weight gain, or it's promoting weight gain. So it's an unfavorable situation to be in, and it's the real reason why we, you know, as clinicians and also as patients, need to understand why we're failing, because, again, then we can make those informed choices the next time we're going to lose weight.
And it's interesting that you said that the levels go higher than they were in baseline for ghrelin. So it's really, you know, it's almost like a stair step. Each time it gets worse.
Yeah, look, that's exactly right. So visually think of it. You've got ghrelin at a certain level, then you lose weight and it goes up. But then even after I stack the weight back on and I take a blood sample off you and measure ghrelin again, the level hasn't come back to baseline. It continues to remain elevated, telling you to go and eat more food. Now, another fascinating example is the metabolism. A very clever scientist in the US followed up contestants from a TV show where they lose weight. They measure the metabolism at the start. They measure it again after they lose weight. Of course, you'd expect it to drop, but it drops by about 15% that us clinicians and scientists can't account for. But then even again, when you go and follow these people up 6 years down the track, after they've stacked the weight back on, the metabolism has not recovered. It remains suppressed. So you continue to burn less calories at rest. And this is why you often put on more weight than you lost, or what we refer to as the plus GST.
Yeah. The extra 10%, right?
It's all doom and gloom, isn't it, at the moment? But unfortunately, this is just how clever our body is and how good it is at, you know, sort of preventing any further weight loss and ensuring you go back to where you started.
Yeah, and it tells us why the human species has been around for thousands of years, because of these mechanisms. What else happens? What other compensatory mechanisms occur with weight loss?
Yeah, look, another fascinating one is what's happening within the brain. Now, we do meal studies, and when we sit down participants to certain meals before they've lost weight, after they've lost weight, after they've regained weight, for instance. Now, what we see is actually a change for different foods. So before we're, you know, I guess trying to lose weight, but we're stuck in this sort of overweight or carrying excess weight, we tend to seek out lower fat or lower calorie foods, more nutritious options. But then when we go and lose weight, again, just a clinically significant amount of weight, can be just, say, 3 kilos or more, our preference for foods changes. It then starts to say, hang on, we've got to get more of those calorie-rich foods in. So it starts seeking out more high-fat, high-sugar foods. So we crave those packaged and processed foods that we see on every corner of every block. And we can assess this through brain imaging. So it's really, I guess, complex in terms of what's happening, but it's not just hormone changes. It's also, you know, what's going on within our brain, the foods we're seeking out, metabolism changing, all this cascade of physiological responses, or they're all taking place in order to take you back to your start point.
And I can imagine that food scientists are probably really knowledgeable in this space, and that is why foods are so hyper palatable and calorie dense, because they're really taking advantage of this compensatory mechanism that occurs.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, their job is to make sure food tastes good, to ensure we go back for it. Now, every time we see this process in fast food, packaged food. Now, a good example is the bakery. As we walk past that bakery, dopamine is released in the brain, in the pleasure center. It's that learning chemical triggering that response to tell you, last time I had that, it actually tasted, it smells and tasted good. So mm-hmm. I go back into the bakery and I crave that food and I get that food again because it's giving me that high that I'm looking for. But the interesting thing is we all have always sought out this high. Mm. But as hunter-gatherers, we used to get this high from nature's treats, from foods naturally found in the environment, those that are naturally high in sugar, naturally high in fat. So mm-hmm. think of foods like fruits, your papaya, your berries, your nuts and your seeds, your avocado. But unfortunately, we're now getting that high that we're looking for from processed and fast foods. And they've become the everyday food and we're addicted to those foods when they should be just the everyday occurrence. So what we've got to be able to do is, and what we get our patients to do is retrain their brain back to nature's treat so we can satisfy the high, mm-hmm. but we can also fill them up on really nutrient-dense calorie, low-calorie foods. So they get the high they're looking for, but they also feel great after the time of consumption because those processed and fast foods often make us feel quite depressed not long after eating them.
Yeah, and the shame and the negative self-talk that I see clinically that comes as a result of eating those foods is just incredible.
Yeah, it is. And this is one of the biggest challenges we have in this modern-day environment. This food is not going anywhere. We need to embrace the modern-day environment for what it is, but we need to get the enjoyment from those foods as the occasional, which is what we used to get from, but now it's become that everyday occurrence. And it's having this flow-on effect with the family. Young children are even screaming out to that food as we go down the supermarket aisles and we see that food screaming out to us. So, yes, we've got to satisfy that high. We don't want to cut out foods and food groups because that's just what the dieting industry is sort of packaging up to get us quick results. Mm-hmm. This is about embracing the environment and retraining our brain back to nature's treats.
Exactly. And I'm wondering about the role of inflammation because I see low-grade inflammation in a lot of my patients and I'd love to know, you know, what role does it play in driving obesity or in maintaining obesity?
Yeah, unfortunately, when we get into that state of, I guess, carrying excess body weight, we are in this, again, state of low-grade inflammation. So if we take bloods, we're going to see that in those measures. So really what we've got to be focusing on is making those slow but steady changes to our habits. And that's not just around diet, but it's also around exercise and sleep. Because if we can get a person to then lose a clinically significant amount of weight and importantly keep it off long term, the inflammation goes away and they also reverse often a lot of health conditions or diseases they might currently have. So really this is not a short-term fix. It's not going to happen overnight. It's all about resetting a person or patient's mindset to the long term, getting them to focus on health, not weight, because we're also fixated on the number on the scales. We all want that quick instant gratification, but that's not the answer. We've been doing this for the better part of 5 decades, and if anything, dieting is only contributing to that problem that it proclaims to solve. It's going to drive up a person's set point or starting weight over time. And some really fascinating research for that comes from more than 4,000 sets of twins where they followed them up over 25 years. And they found the twin that had been dieting actually ended up having a higher body weight than the twin that had never dieted. So it's obviously, you know, making your situation worse. And it's really important to get out of that cycle and you know, regain control of your health and your weight by just changing unhealthy behaviours with new positive behaviours and listening to evidence-based science and stop following fads.
Yeah, and there's so much white noise in this space for patients. It gets very confusing.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, look, we're all supposed experts in the modern-day environment. You'll find an expert everywhere on social media that proclaims to know what they're talking about. But I must stress, obesity really is a complex science. And as we have this conversation, it should be empowering you with, you know, that information so you can understand how your body's working or how your patient's body's working the minute they start losing weight. This is what we're up against. And the only way to overcome that is by offering evolutionary solutions. An evolutionary problem, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, I love that. You mentioned before blood samples. What kind of biomarkers are you looking at in bloods?
Yeah, look, we're very interested in appetite hormones because this is what's having a huge role in regulating our weight day to day. And when we wake up, you know, what's telling us when and where to eat is this appetite regulation system. So we've got some like the ghrelin that's acting on the brain telling you to go and reach for food. And we've got other hormones produced from other organs or the gastrointestinal tract telling you to put down the fork or the spoon. So we're particularly interested in these because if we can switch those off and ensure that they're not, you know, we're not seeing that heightened response after a person's losing weight, we can switch off those evolutionary barriers that we're up against. So that's what we're really interested in when we're looking at a person's weight loss journey and also other factors like metabolism to ensure that we can get them losing weight predominantly from body fat as opposed to, you know, body fat and muscle mass. We're going to be losing some muscle mass as we go along the journey because our body mass is going down, but we've really got to hold on to that as much as we can to keep our metabolism high. Yeah. And this is why exercise and physical activity plays an important role too.
And in relation to metabolism, what kind of biomarkers are you looking at to assess metabolism?
Yeah, look, we have a lot of fancy imaging in our facility where we're very lucky to start state-of-the-art facility at Charles Perkins Centre, Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. And, you know, we can put people in fancy imaging machines like BOD pods and DEXAs, and we can assess the change in body composition and metabolism or metabolic rate over time. So remember, this is what we want to keep or preserve. We want to switch off those evolutionary barriers. And this is sort of, you know, I guess comes to translational science in terms of what you should be doing as opposed to what we're currently doing, which hasn't worked for the better part of 5 decades. Mm-hmm. But I guess, look, it's important to, yes, be monitoring a person's journey over time, but not get too bogged down in the details because sometimes we get too caught up in all of those numbers. Mm-hmm. And it is far simpler than what we make it out to believe or what the dieting industry has done a very good job at making complex over time. It really comes down to, you know, ingraining healthy habits and following that evidence-based care. Then you will see the positive changes in all of those metrics we're talking about.
Yeah, that is true. I was reading, researching for this episode, reading a meta-analysis about probiotics and weight, and the overall consensus was that probiotic therapy has positive effects on body weight, BMI, and fat percentage, which I thought was interesting. And I know that you have done some research on the gut microbiome and its impact on obesity. What do you think the mechanisms of action are here? And are there a couple of key takeaways that you've discovered?
Yes. Look, unfortunately, people, they're in that overweight or obesity state. When we take poo samples, the gut microbiome doesn't look that great. Mm-hmm. And it does, and then we can often correlate that with the food they're consuming or the food they're putting into their body. But what we also find is that when they lose weight, that gut microbiome actually improves. And that's the very, I guess, positive note to really reinforce there. It's not just due to the weight loss, but it's also due to that change in eating behaviour, particularly around getting more fibre in there and more dairy products, which is promoting a lot of that growth of good bacteria. So again, like we often get caught up in too much of that nitty-gritty detail, but if we can just make small changes to our diet over time and lose that clinically significant amount of weight, we do see that significant improvement in the gut microbiome when we measure it through taking stool samples.
It's really interesting how the gut microbiome is so critical for its kind of cause and effect of a lot of things in the body. And I see that big cause and effect in relation to inflammation and a lot of the hormone pathways.
Yeah, definitely, most definitely. And look, it is really important to stress that a lot of it does start with what we are eating. We've seen a significant shift in the food we're putting into our body, particularly as the modern-day environment is saturated with a lot more processed discretionary foods. Mm. Unfortunately, we're going to those as the everyday. It means a worsening of our gut health over time. And we do need to start making smarter and healthier choices and retraining our brain back to nature's treats. Still embracing those discretionary processed fast foods, but they need to become the once per week, not the everyday occurrence, which we are seeing with the patients we see in our hospital clinics.
And what about, this is a tricky one, weight regain in menopause. I read the Women's Healthy Lifestyle Project clinical trial, and I'd really love you to talk us through what it showed and then what we can implement off the back of this with our patients.
Yeah, look, there's no debating that women go through a lot of significant life changes that men do not have to worry about. And now I'm talking about earlier on, it might be going on the contraceptive pill, and then it might be going through pregnancy or multiple pregnancies, and then midlife going through menopause and the challenges that presents. Now, there's no questioning that hormone and the hormonal balance is shifting during that time of menopause, making it harder to really hold on to your weight. And you also see a change in the fat deposition, so it's moving around the body, and it's quite, I guess, confronting. Now, what we also find, though, and what a lot of these research studies are finding, is that the real reason we're struggling to maintain our weight during that time is because our lifestyle changes. Mm-hmm. We're not actually devoting as much time to our health as we once did. We're not focusing on that daily exercise, physical activity. Our health and eating habits have actually changed, whether we believe it or not, and we're not getting as good sleep as we once did. So all of those things are contributing to that very small incidental weight gain that you start to see during menopause. And that, you know, that couple of kilos can quickly add up to 5 kilos, and then you find yourself in a position where you might then be diagnosed with, you know, obesity. So look, there's no questioning, coming back to your question, that hormones are changing during that time, but the research has shown the very reason we're really putting that weight on is because lifestyle's changing. Our body's starting to slow down. Things like sarcopenia coming into play, where we're seeing a slight decrease in muscle mass and increase in fat mass. We're also seeing a shift in where fat is deposited throughout the body, particularly in women, and it's making it harder to keep that weight off long term. That's why we've really got to focus on our health. It's got to become that number one priority all the time, but particularly during those times of life and when at menopause, when it's even harder to maintain your weight.
And I find that women in this life stage are often very stressed. They've maybe got kids that are at high school or uni, or they've got parents that are elderly. They're usually still working, and they feel very compressed, and that stress picture is often quite high as well.
Yeah, look, they're juggling multiple different demands in life. It might be more seniority at work, and like you said, children or multiple children, and they're, what they're doing is putting everyone else first, and they're often, that means their own health is falling down the bottom of the priority pile, and it does then take its toll over time. So I guess it's so important to really look after yourself and prioritise your lifestyle habits, and it's not just around diet. Remember, it's also around exercise and sleep health. And if you want to prevent the weight gain during those particularly challenging times of life, that's when your health needs to be prioritised even more.
That is true. Put your own oxygen mask on first. Now, I remember the Matador study when it came out in 2017. It was only small. It only had 45 male participants, but the results were really interesting. The men that dieted for 2 weeks, then took a 2-week break, fared a lot better when it came to weight regain. And when aiming for the outcome of sustainable weight loss, can you tell us the research or the reasoning behind the diet breaks? Now, don't forget, for those of you listening, all of this information will be in the show notes, where you'll find a full transcript of the episode and references to any studies that we mention.
Yeah, so look, it's one thing for us to be measuring what happens within a person's body when they're losing weight. And I guess to date, this conversation has been quite doom and gloom. You know, your body shuts down, it fights the weight loss, and you're going to go back to where you started. Well, that's pretty much how it goes. And this is why we keep failing, and why diets haven't worked for the better part of 5 decades. But the other positive news is we also research solutions to overcome this evolutionary problem we're up against.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of those is now translated to the general public, and it's called interval weight loss. It's not to be confused with intermittent fasting.
Okay.
And it's now based on years and years and years of scientific research. Now, what we've found, as you alluded to, is that when we get a person to lose weight in small intervals every second month,
mm-hmm.
of only a couple of kilos, we're actually switching off a lot of these biological protections that come into play when we typically lose a clinically significant amount of weight. So we don't see them dropping metabolism. We don't see the appetite hormones changing, telling us to eat more. We don't see the adrenal glands pumping out more cortisol or the thyroid gland being suppressed. We don't see the brain function changing. So visually, mm-hmm. you know, for the listeners, it's basically a step-down pyramid approach. A couple of kilos of weight loss, roughly 0.5 kilo of weight loss per week over the course of a month.
Yeah.
And then the patient then has to maintain the weight for the second month or the next month. Then they're allowed to go on and lose a weight again during the third month. Then they have to maintain the weight during the fourth month and so on until they hit their goal weight. So, yeah, these randomized controlled trials are showing that people can typically lose 10 to 12 kilos over the course of a given year. Now, typically diets achieve that in the space of a few months,
yeah.
and then we put that weight back on just as quick. So you see a U or V-shaped response. But with the interval weight loss, what you're seeing is a drop down across, drop down across, drop down across, drop down across. And that's because it's allowing the body to reset at its new set point along the way. And it's not fighting itself every single time. So it's allowing a person to redefine their set point and find, I guess, that inner silhouette that exists within all of us. but this is a way of, you know, offering an evolutionary solution to an evolutionary problem. And just very most recently, University of Wollongong have published a sort of head-to-head study
mm-hmm.
looking at real-world results of the very few credible programs out there, such as interval weight loss, CSIRO, Weight Watchers and the likes.
Yeah.
And those on interval weight loss came out on, in terms of the results, number one, they're losing a great amount of weight with respect to 5% and 10% weight loss for 12 months or longer. So it's very positive news. It does work long term, and that's because we're working with our biology, not against it.
And I love that you said before more than 3 kilogram weight loss will cause that set point resistance. So by keeping just under the 3 kilos on average allows the body to adapt and lower that set point without all of these compensatory mechanisms kicking in, resulting in a safe and effective weight loss, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And look, it's never going to be a picture-perfect, you know, weight loss journey. But yes, that's what we're aiming for, roughly a couple of kilos over the course of a month. Because if we go beyond that and we start losing 3 or 4 or 5 kilos a month, we start triggering that cascade of physiological responses, all of those ones we've been talking about in depth and many of, you know, all that research that I've written about extensively. So, yes, we need to keep that at bay. We've got to prevent that coming into play, and this is why we just aim for a couple of kilos every second month.
Yeah, I love that. And what I do love about it is you can also zoom out with the patient and say, look, in 12 months from now, it's quite possible that you would be 10 to 12 kilos lighter than you are right now. And I think when you zoom out, it really helps that motivation as well.
Yeah, look, and most of them have had their lived experience through yo-yo dieting and trying every weight loss program under the sun. They will know that lived experience of weight loss followed by weight regain, which is typically the U or V-shaped response. Whereas if you show them that visual response of step down across without the physiological protections coming into play, then yes, they relate to it. And they're also going to, you know, hopefully stick to that long-term vision, because what you've got to do is prevent them losing weight when they get when they see that number on the scales going down. When we get to the second month, you've got to take the foot off the accelerator, put the foot on the brake, and ensure you actually maintain the weight from the month before.
Okay. Now, I read a really fascinating 2022 review that suggested that to offset this metabolic adaptation to weight loss, we also should be targeting both the increased hunger and the decreased energy expenditure. And the authors looked at dietary protein, fiber, and exercise. They discussed research that demonstrated 30 to 48 grams of protein above normal intake per day resulted in less weight regain. So in relation to protein, do you have any recommendations for us?
Yes. With respect to protein, it's something that we also become a bit fixated on in this modern day environment. We're looking for high protein yogurts, for example. High protein water, believe it or not.
I mean, it's a thing.
It's a thing. Yeah. Who would ever thought it would be? Mm. Now, yogurt or dairy is already high in protein. Okay. Now, what we are doing a good job at is actually getting enough protein in our diet.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we're getting too many of those discretionary processed foods, which are high in carbohydrates, which are high in added sugars.
Yeah.
Now, those foods are very low in nutrition, low in fiber, and don't fill us up for long periods of time. So it often puts that balance out of whack with respect to how much fat, protein, and carb you should be getting throughout the day.
So
when people are following interval weight loss in the palm of their hand as an online program, they're just told that you need to simply balance every meal, because believe it or not, it is as simple as that. And if you do that, you will meet your protein requirements across the course of the day and succeed long-term with your weight loss journey and prevent weight regain. So visually, that would look like a meal that contains carbohydrate, protein, and fat. So for example, breakfast, you might have your oats with your source of dairy. It could be milk, yogurt.
Yeah.
You could also have your nature's treat on there, being your honey or your berries.
Mm-hmm.
And the protein can also be the dairy source.
Mm.
But importantly, that meal is balanced. Okay. You can also throw some nut butter in there to add even more nutrition and balance to it. But basically, they're just taught to add in a source of whole grain carbohydrate, a source of protein, and a source of good fat to every meal. If you do that across the course of the day, you're going to be meeting your protein requirements. And importantly, we're retraining their brain back to nature's treats to help them with the emotional and comfort eating and get them off the processed and packaged foods as an everyday occurrence.
So
when you start to do that, you see a shift in that, you know, macronutrient composition, and importantly, getting the foods that fill you up into your body, that fill you up for a long period of time. So don't get too caught up in this hype about protein. What we've really got to do is retrain the brain back to nature's treats, and that sees a shift in macronutrient composition, and also importantly, just get our patients to balance every meal throughout the day.
Yeah, I like that. It's a very sound principle, and it is really just a whole foods approach to eating.
Absolutely. It most definitely is. This is not about, you know, cutting out certain foods or food groups. A lot of that information that we have been fed over the many years is misleading. It's wrong. It's often doing more damage than good, because often those foods that we're told to take out, for example, the fruits, because they contain sugar, and I'm putting that in inverted commas. Mm-hmm. Now, these are naturally occurring sugars, which are good for our health. These foods are full of nutrition to fill us up for long periods of time. These aren't the foods we should be taking out, nor should we be taking out the nuts and the seeds or the dairy because of its supposed fat content. We really need to start listening to healthcare professionals that know what they're talking about. And if a diet is telling you to take out certain foods or food groups, it already has red flags.
Yeah. Nick, what about dealing with what I call the dopamine hunt? And that's what I call it to patients in clinic. And you talked a little about dopamine at the beginning. You know, there's a significant level of emotional hunger as opposed to physical hunger. And I see this really distinct pattern in clinic of patients chasing this, which invariably sabotages all their efforts. It's hedonic eating. But food addictions are also very powerful. So how can we address this dopamine hunt? Like, what tools can we pull out of our toolkit to support these patients better?
Yeah, it's probably one of the biggest things we're up against. You know, we've obviously got these biological protections and physiological responses that take place with weight loss, but the real reason we're struggling with our weight is because of this Emotional and comfort eating. Mm. Now, particularly in the afternoon, it's based on circadian rhythm. It's also based on, for instance, the day of work and how we manage stress at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Typically, that is with food rather than exercise.
Mm.
Now, we're all going to be getting, I guess, these highs now throughout the day. And what that means is this urge to eat something high in sugar, high in fat. Remember, this is what something we always used to seek out. You wind back the clock tens of thousands of years, and our hunter-gatherers would search out foods that gave us best bang for our buck, that foods that are naturally high in sugar and fat. So what we're doing is getting them to retrain their brain. So when dopamine's being released, when you walk past that bakery, remember the learning chemical telling you that it smells and tastes good, we tell ourselves four words as part of the IWL Interval Weight Loss Plan. It's reach for nature first.
Yeah.
So that means we've got to start surrounding ourselves with nature's treats. So when you get that urge to eat something sugary or fatty, you've got to have a nature's treat. Now, that might be a piece of fruit. It might be some nuts and seeds. It could be some avocado and whole grain bread.
Mm.
Believe it or not, it still gives you the same high you're looking for. When you eat that food, it releases all of those feel-good chemicals in the brain.
Yeah.
But it fills you up for long periods of time. It makes you feel great afterwards, and it gives you that high that we're all looking for. So to satisfy that dopamine hit, you've got to reach for nature first, and we've got to start retraining our brain back to nature's treats, because believe it or not, it does give you that high.
Mm, I think a lot of people are used to the very fast, urgent dopamine release, and they're not understanding that there can be maybe a softer, slower dopamine release that still gets to the same high but isn't quite as intense feeling-wise. But it is such a tricky one to work with patients in this space. So I admire all the work that you have done in the research and with your program. I do want to pick your brains on GLP-1 medications. A quick question I wanted to throw to you at some point. If you can just give us your opinion of pros and cons of them.
Yes, look, for the better part of two decades, we haven't really had any effective weight management medications.
Mm.
There was often a few on, there was a couple on the market that didn't really give much weight loss. Many were trialed and tested and pulled from market due to various safety concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we actually have now a wide range of medications. More and more will start to become approved over time. And the research shows that, yes, while we're taking them, it produces weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, when we follow these people up after they've come off the medication, they've regained the weight they lost.
Mm.
Okay, so it's an appetite suppressant while we take it, but there's many reasons why people don't continue to take it. One can be due to side effects. Another could be accessibility, particularly in the current market, but also affordability.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first consideration. When you come off that medication, you will regain the weight. That's what the data shows from randomized controlled trials. Now, the second thing is, if you're going to take an anti-obesity medication, which has gone through all of that vigorous clinical trial research, which is now approved for use, for instance, in Australia, you still need to make changes to your lifestyle. You still need to be following evidence-based lifestyle intervention. So that would mean, in this instance, following the IWR program to ensure you make changes to your exercise, to your sleep health, and to your diet, because that will then set you up for long-term success, to ensure you're making changes around what you put into your body, to ensure you're getting more daily movement, and to ensure you're getting a much better sleep health routine in place. Because what we're often doing or seeing is people are taking the drug but not actually making any changes to their lifestyle.
Mm.
So it's important to address that as well.
Yeah, I have to say it's a big clinical frustration of mine. I don't have any problem at all with the medication, but I do really sit my patients down and tell them very honestly, you know, if we don't change your environment, then nothing will change long term in relation to your weight. It is a problem of mindset, I believe.
Yeah, and look, especially the way we're accessing them nowadays, the answer is not just getting a script and getting the medication or being posted a medication. It is about making changes to your lifestyle, following evidence-based care and overhauling your relationship with diet, exercise and sleep. Otherwise, you will not get long-term results.
Exactly. So in the patients that you have worked with, what patterns do you tend to see in the people that are successful with their long-term weight loss? Are there any anecdotal pieces of evidence or any research-backed factors that you've seen in practice that we can be aware of?
Yeah, so importantly, remember, we are scientists and clinicians. We are not discussing anecdotal stories here. This is about real clinical evidence, scientifically published papers in peer-reviewed journals. So one is discussing and reviewing and publishing on what happens within the body when we're losing weight, why it's so hard. The other one is about the solution and overcoming the evolutionary problem.
Yeah.
And we know with our patients that are on interval weight loss, IWL, losing weight in small intervals every second month, they succeed long term. We're getting better results than the few credible programs that exist on the market. Now, unfortunately, there's a lot of different options out there when it comes to diet programs, not just in Australia, but across the globe. But the sad thing is the majority have no evidence to back up their claims, and they're largely based on very good marketing. So when you're making a decision, you've got to follow an evidence-based program, and you've got to appreciate that we are up against this evolutionary problem, so we need an evolutionary solution. It's not a quick fix. You can get long-term results, but only if you focus on the long-term and focus on things like health rather than weight. So if we can get a person to say, hey, let's check out what's happening with your cardiovascular risk factors from baseline and measure those over time and get them to focus on that rather than just weight, because weight loss tends to then become just more so a side effect of those new healthy habits that you're putting into place.
I love the refocus onto health instead of the number on the scale. I think that that is so forward thinking.
It's so important. I think from the minute you want to do something about regaining control of your health and your weight, take that focus off scales. Stop weighing yourself every day. Now, yes, we do get our patients to weigh themselves, but it's just once a week to monitor the trend in weight over time. Same day, same play, same scales, same clothing, so that you can aim for that rough 2 kilos of weight loss during a weight loss month and to ensure you maintain your weight every second month. So it's not about fixating on, you know, why your weight changed after a certain meal or food you just ate. It's about actually seeing, I've just made some changes to my lifestyle. What is happening to the trend in my weight over time? And importantly, if you focus on health and you're following this evidence-based information, you're going to see improvements in your health from day one. But believe it or not, you may not see the improvements or drastic drop in weight loss from day one because you've done so much damage to your weight or your metabolism over time through dieting. So, again, this is why it's important to focus on health, vitality, cardiovascular and diabetes risk factors. All of those things add up to paint a better picture of what, I guess, your health looks like over time.
Fantastic. And for those of you that don't know the interval weight loss, there's six principles. I'll run through them quickly. Nick, you can correct me if I get them wrong.
Okay.
The first one is you can't fight evolution, so you need to impose weight loss breaks every second month, like you mentioned. Reach for nature first, so retrain your brain to rely on nature's treats. There's another principle of the full rainbow. Eat more than you're used to and fill your plate with vegetables first. No foods are eliminated. The next one I love, use chopsticks with your evening meal and eat big to small throughout the day. Number five was choose to move, incorporate daily activity into your life, making sure there's variety within that. And the last one, this is very naturopathic, I think, no blue light after twilight, switch off all technology, focus on reading or your hobbies or just tackle your to-do list. A really nice holistic frame on weight loss, I feel.
Yeah, and again, remember, it's about following a certain methodology around how we lose weight, but also importantly, forming habits that last a lifetime. So, you know, we've got to replace a lot of those unhealthy habits with new healthy habits. So that we talked about the emotional comfort eating or the dopamine high that we need to satisfy. Again, we've got to surround our environment with nature's treats and tell ourselves reach for nature first when we feel that urge to eat something high in sugar, high in fat. When we're sitting down to a meal, just not worrying about you know, meticulously weighing out grams of food or counting calories, because again, our body's far too smart for that, and it's not as simple as just calories in versus calories out.
No.
We've got to, you know, make sure each meal's balanced, and we eat from big to small. And why do we do that? Because our research clearly shows that you burn the calories 2.5 times more efficiently in the morning versus the evening. But again, fads have led us to believe that we should be skipping breakfast, like intermittent fasting. We cut out breakfast, but that's the most important meal from a metabolic point of view. So that's the meal we need to ramp up, and we need to then taper off on our food intake throughout the day. And those changes in hunger don't happen overnight. They happen if you persist with that change over time. Just like if you're strengthening a muscle in the gym, you've got to repeatedly do it, and over time you start to see those improvements and changes.
Yeah, fantastic. So it's a bit of a summary. There's so much in today's discussion, but if a patient comes to us with that history of weight regain, we could suggest things like educating them about that evolutionary mismatch of the set point theory and the adaptations their body undergoes to keep them at a certain weight, like changes in their appetite hormones and their basal metabolic rate. I think it's really important to educate them that a 3 kilo weight loss or more at that point, your body will start to protect that weight loss and bring those adaptive mechanisms into play. And that we also want to implement some diet breaks to really support satiety, and that no food's off the table. I think that's great.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, empower that patient with the education, because you're more likely to get them on board and to make those evidence-based decisions going forward, and to hopefully break that yo-yo dieting cycle if they're currently stuck in it.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Nick. I've really enjoyed all the wisdom and the pearls of knowledge you've shared with us.
Thank you very much, Emma, for having me on, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine by Bioceuticals website. I'm Emma Sutherland. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine, and share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.